I just knew it was my wife coming in, so I just.
I think we're good there.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome to Pepperdine. I hope you've probably already been to a couple classes. But, man, this place is special to me. I had the privilege of spending 6 months out here. My wife has drugged me out here, and she was like a visiting lecturer, and so I love being back here. So, and especially with Dr. Beck here. So, yeah, come on in. So, anyway, I'm David Todd Harmon. I know you're all here for me, and you happen to be privileged to meet him as well. This is Richard Beck. So I'm David Todd Harmon. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Manna Nutrition. That is a title that I gave myself to get in meetings that I don't deserve to be in. So, before you get nervous about my credentials, I actually help kids gain weight. So I'm actually pretty, I have the credentials for that. So kids 6 months to 6 years old that are starving to death, severely, acutely malnourished, we make a product for them. Our initial inclination was to encourage them to lose weight. We thought that was an effective way to gain weight for guys like me in the United States, but eventually we had to build a factory and actually make a product to feed these kids. So we make a, that'll come up eventually. That's just a peanut butter paste. So we're called ready-to-use therapeutic food. And we pump out, I don't know, 500,000 of these a day. And distribute them to the Africa and South America and different parts of Asia. So anyway, that's what we do. That's what I do. So I do have a Bible degree. So I have, at least read the Bible a little bit. But I'm a marriage and family therapist. So somehow we're at a Bible lecture. You have a therapist and a psychologist. So don't expect a lot of answers.
How do you feel? How does it make
you feel? Yes. And he's a psychologist. We're doing that. He'll talk about Darwin at some point. So that's what I do. And in doing this, we made this company kind of out of thin air. My buddy and I, Mark Moore, who spoke here the last couple of years and who dumped this session on me. So you stuck with me. But he's actually very articulate and very good at this and likes this stuff. Me, I had to bring in help. So we started this kind of out of thin air and started a company. And I felt like I'd been to like marriage seminars and I'd been to like parenting classes. I'd been to, men's retreats, and my wife went to women's retreats, and no one ever said, how do you start a business? You know, no one ever said, what should you pay people? If you're a Christian and you take the gospel seriously, what should you pay yourself? You know, do you hire convicts or not? What level of convicts? So anyway, in that experience, I felt like I've had a really, eventful and educational way of just looking at how someone who tries to take the gospel seriously should act at work, you know. So that's kind of my background. And so the topic here is kind of loosely James, but it's really about James and the gospel, kind of calling us to selflessness. That's kind of the gist of James, as far as I can tell. You can disagree in your own time. But that's kind of what I get from it. Be selfless. And I go to work and there's this kind of unavoidable self-interest that I have to compete with. I have to contribute my own, efforts and abilities and kind of rank and prioritize and evaluate the contribution of others. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. So yeah, that's kind of kids we feed right there. It's Clarice. Her brother was also fed. So just get plumped up in 4 weeks. So again, it's pretty exciting stuff. I'll tell you more about it at a later date. So I'm hoping in this session, my experience will hopefully add some value to your time here. You flew all this way. So hopefully add some value, but also through the lens that Dr. Beck's going to give us, through the slavery of death, his book. We'll talk more about that in a second. For us to just, how do we talk to our congregants? If we're ministers and elders and teachers, mentors, how do we go back to our congregation and convince folks that what happens from 9 to 5, come on in, Steve, is critically important to the life of the church? And so, in my work, like I said, I kind of hinted at, what do you pay yourself? What do you pay your employees? Do you hire convicts? You know, I've had opportunities for some of the most redemptive work and some of the most destructive work I've ever seen in my life, you know, and I've been in both camps. Like I've made decisions where I look back and think, ooh, that is antithetical to the gospel, you know. And other times I feel like this is the gospel at work, you know, no pun intended. So anyway, we'll hopefully jump into that. Days 2 and 3, if you come back, we'll have Steve, who just walked in tomorrow, and we'll have Jason Russell, and hopefully will be an idea of not so much a prescription for you and your church and your congregants, whatever, but more of a, this is how we kind of stumble through this tension of how we do work and take the gospel seriously at the same time. And so you're seeing my factory, I don't know what all you've seen lit. I had to just put them on auto because I'll forget to click and you'll miss all these things I put together. There's our team. And so, so the real goal of the class is you take this home and get creative and challenge your congregations to apply the gospel to their work and live in that tension and speak to that in meaningful and profound ways. Because I felt like at times I've ignored that and gone off the reservation that way, and other times I feel like we've embraced that and really done powerful things. I'll share some of those stories as the week goes. So, anyway, so 6 months ago, I was supposed to do this class. I had to put a topic together and kind of just gave a generic topic, as you saw, and try to figure out what I want to talk about. I want to talk about work. I want to talk about this tension. And I looked at some of the Trappist community stuff, some of the monks and how they do business. There's some good stuff there. And I just kept coming back to Dr. Beck's book. I'm going to call you Richard. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So I figured. So, Richard's book, Slavery of Death. I just kept coming back to that and felt like Trappist communities and different things. A lot of this leadership and business stuff that I really like was more about kind of rearranging the furniture. And this book was really more about we got problems in the foundation we need to shore up. And I thought that was really powerful for me. And so this was also powerful as I was coming up with my class. My iPhone, I updated it and said, do you want to use True North? And I said, what the heck is True North? I had to Google it. I don't know what that is. You know, I haven't done a lot of hiking with a real map, I guess, but had no idea. I Googled it, and True North is different than Magnetic North. I don't even know this. This was profound for me. I was sitting there just paralyzed. Like, I thought it was like gravity, North. These were, you know, as a young guy who's relativity, I thought those were two things that aren't relatable. They are. So, that's an image we'll point to throughout the week a little bit. It's the title of the class, kind of lost in the right direction, idea. That metaphor plays out in a couple ways. We'll hopefully touch on that a little bit, but, so that was kind of a funny, funny kind of realization. I was reading this book and found that and thought, this is it. This is lost in the right direction is really kind of a description of how we try to do it at Manna, you know, how we tried to live the gospel and also make money, or stay alive at least. Anyway, that's the image there. There's your, so now you have that, you have the table of elements, and so you should be, if you're nothing else, a decent reminder of a science lesson. So anyway, so slavery of death. I just want to talk to you about, Richard. So, I don't know who's read it or who's not. We'll assume folks haven't read it. You got to give us the premise of the book in terms of what you mean by that.
Yeah. Hey, before I get into that, I just want to say that I think you're a superstar. You know, I might have a blog, but you guys, they're saving lives, you know, like every day. And so, I mean, just what you and Mark are doing.
Thank you.
You've
been a big fan of ours. I appreciate it.
Remember, Manna and when the Manabago came through, which apparently burned up.
Just right miles out, from here.
Miles, it blew up outside.
We did a college campaign talking about Manna, and our Winnebago caught on fire just north of here.
Yeah. So. And there's a video of it online. It's pretty exciting.
So. I should have showed that. I need a video for today. I should have done that.
But I took my sons down to that. They had a display thing down there and just showed them about the, you know, the SAM kids, severe acute malnutrition, and just give our boys and a vision of social justice and that kind of thing. And so I'm honored to be in your presence, sir.
Well, thank you.
I mean, it's amazing. So anyway, The Slavery of Death is a book. The premise of the book, it takes, to be real brief, plays with this text in Hebrews 2, 14, 15, if you haven't read the book. But in that text it says...
I just got random stuff playing.
Okay, yeah.
If they get bored, they can read that.
Okay. It says that the reason the Son of God appeared was to set us free from the one who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and to free those who have been enslaved all their lives to the fear of death. And so that's where the title of the book comes from, The Slavery of Death. So it describes our predicament as the human predicament, the reason why Jesus came. usually we think Jesus came, died to save us from sin, but this says it came, you know, the reason the Son of God appears to free us from this power of the devil, and the power of the devil is slavery, lifelong slavery, all our lives enslaved to the fear of death, which is a weird idea for Protestants, Church of Christ kinds of persons, but it is the regulating idea in the Eastern Orthodox tradition. In the Eastern Orthodox tradition, death is the predominant predicament. That's the deeper predicament. And so their basic concept is they have a distinction between the Western tradition's vision of what's called original sin. So there's a sin, and it introduces death into the world. And then what we inherit from Adam and Eve is this kind of congenital moral defect. You know, we're all kind of bound over to sin. So that's our problem, is a flaw in our character. We're wicked in inclination. But the Orthodox, they have a vision called ancestral sin. And they say, yes, sin introduced death into the world. And so the passage in Paul where it says, you know, because of sin, death came. Their argument is that, but what we inherit from Adam and Eve is the condition that they didn't inherit. We are born into a world where we're born dying. Death is already kind of contaminated and saturated our spirits and our souls. And so, and it's the anxieties associated with our mortality and our finiteness, our neediness, our frailty as human beings. It's that frailty and that anxiety that becomes the power of the devil. That anxiety becomes the leverage of sin in our lives, the fear that is used, and it's all its variety of manifestations. And so being freed from sin is dealing with this ultimate kind of weakness that we have, a death kind of saturated world. And so the causality is reversed. Instead of sin producing death, as we typically think about it, it's death, being born into death because of Adam and Eve's sin, that produces sin. So in Paul's formulation, the sting of death is sin. And so the book is about anxiety, basically, and about how anxiety, particularly related to mortality fears, create moral failures. And so I try to make this big argument that this anxiety is kind of crackling underneath just about everything we do in our lives, and work is a big part of that, how we deal with our mortal anxieties, you know, quest for significance and meaning, how we build castles of sand, think about Ecclesiastes, to kind of create mortality and immortality of our own making, and how the devil then uses those kind of good things as actually forms of idolatry and spiritual slavery. So that's a premise. Now you don't even get the book.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. Down my pocket. You know.
Save yourself $10.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah. So I mean, I read the book. I was ready to quit my job, even though I have a great job and saving kids. I was ready to like be a farmer.
You don't need. Okay.
Yeah. So I was ready just to like, I don't know, just to cash it all in the sense of the basic anxiety and the neurotic anxiety stuff. I love those, the way those intersect. So the basic anxiety is survival, right?
It's right. Just,
and so I felt like, you know, we kind of talk about with technology and whatnot, the basic survival and the scarcity type stuff is, mm-hmm. isn't as prevalent maybe, but still is. I mean, it's still, I go to work every day. It's really in opposition of the basic, or the basic anxiety, what you call it, I think.
Yeah. So one of the things I do in the book is I make a distinction that psychologists make about anxiety. They talk about basic anxiety and neurotic anxiety. And basic anxiety is like just your basic survival anxiety. It's not neurotic. If you're being chased by a killer and you're running, that's very adaptive anxiety. There's not a mental health issue there at all. Basic anxiety. So whenever you're...
Nothing to diagnose.
Yeah, and so in places of abundance... that doesn't feel like if you walk up to people and say, are you afraid of dying? It's like we feel because of our abundance and our material well-being, we're fairly insulated from basic anxiety. But we do run up against it. My favorite example of this is the final scene of Schindler's List. Do you guys remember the final scene of Schindler's List? And so he's Oscar Schindler's a factory owner, and he's saving Jews by hiring them. And so at times he would have to use bribery. You know, he'd have to sell different things to kind of get one more person in. Or to keep them. And remember at the very end, he's standing there, the war's over, and he's looking at the people he saved, and he looks down like at a ring. And he goes, if I had sold this, that would have been one more person. Why'd I keep this? Why did I sell this car? But many people experience that. Like, if you start moving into locations, marginal populations where there's a great deal of need, like if you go to the third world, or if you just start living, sharing life with the poor in your community, you start looking around at your own life and go, I could pay that bill. I could sell, you know what I mean? And then you quickly start going, but if I start, my mind starts tracing out that trajectory, you know, where does it end? And then all of a sudden you realize my charity, my love, my sacrificial living is really coming up against a physical worry that I might not physically have enough. If not money, energy, or time. More than when I go around and talk to churches and talk about hospitality or any, you know, living like Jesus, or, you know, things we should be talking about. You know, the number one problem is in the church, is in my estimation, is people are tired. They're just physically exhausted. And so you go in there to church and go, we need to be like Jesus. And all they hear is, you're just making me really, really tired. Like, I don't have any room for that kind of thing. And I think a lot of it goes to work.
Yeah.
And so what I'm saying is, if you go into people and say, hey, death anxiety, most people, like, I don't hear it. But if you say you're physically beaten down and tired, you're exhausted. And so when you hear me saying you got to start befriending the poor, and you're like, I don't know how I'm going to fit that in, and it's going to make my life, you know, can I schedule that? Can I, like, be with the poor from 3 to 4
on Friday? Come on, sister.
Yeah, my people get with your people and we'll talk. So that's an example of basic anger, like physical exhaustion, resource exhaustion. It lingers in the background. We all bump against it if you're a sacrificial person. But neurotic, so that's one aspect, the way work makes us tired.
Who do you quote here? What's that guy's name? Romanides, Romanines, what's his name?
Romanides?
Yeah. I'm not gonna pronounce that.
Eastern Orthodox.
So he sums it up that the basic anxiety, I feel like this line, like, gets at it. Just says, you know, because of death, man must first attend to the necessities of life in order to stay alive. In this struggle, self-interest are unavoidable.
Right.
But it's basic. That's, you can get that. Everybody here can get that. It says, if the gospel is calling us to selflessness, at the end of the day, there's some aspect of self-interest that we, just to stay alive.
To
maintain life. But then you have neurotic anxiety as well.
Yeah, because we're finite, we will die, self-interest is unavoidable. Yeah. You know, at some point, you're going to have to feed yourself, take care of your family. And so that's the Orthodox framing. You're not selfish because you're wicked. You're not selfish because you're morally depraved. You're selfish because you're a biological being.
So there's death.
Exactly. Yeah. So death, that is what... That's our struggle, is we're always constantly... So it's not, you're not a bad person for trying to take care of your family, trying to get a nap. That doesn't make you wicked, but you're always pitting self-interest against sacrifice in that tension. It's hard to know what to do about that. But neurotic anxiety is the difference. So neurotic anxiety is, okay, so physical anxiety and basic anxiety is one thing, but neurotic anxiety is this is the way we construct self-esteem and meaning. Like, we look back at life and we say, that's a good life. That's a life worthy of pursuit. And the existential psychologists would say that the reason why we pursue these kinds of things is because we want to, very much like Ecclesiastes talks about, we want to build these kind of things that somehow outlast death. And our self-esteem gets caught up in those projects and the worldviews of our culture about what is a good life or not. And so a lot of those are kind of existential lifeboats that we think we can kind of maybe, you know, make something that lasts. And if not, then you just etch your name on a stone and say, that might last a little bit longer. You know? So there's that kind of sense of making a mark, making a difference. Just think, we have graduation this week at ACU. Just listen to any graduation speech, right? Brene Brown calls it the... And she's awesome, by the way. You should read all the Brené Brown you can get. But she talks about called the shame-based fear of being ordinary. Like, that's that deep existential terror that you live a life and it wouldn't matter. You know, so what does that mean? What does it matter? And so work also becomes, work not only exhausts us, but work also becomes a way of achieving significance in the face of death. And so, therefore, also kind of creates its own spiritual temptations from this neurotic anxiety, self-esteem-based kind of anxiety.
So your stuff about insulating ourselves from death is also pretty powerful. I thought it kind of drives that point home, and that you kind of talk about, and just in our culture, we've, you know, a couple examples here about food. So we went from actually like going out back and like slaughtered a chicken to now we just drive up and get a chicken nugget.
Sure.
Or are we the location? So, you know, we used to, you know, present the dead in our parlor room, and now we push those out to our funeral home. And, you know, we used to help folks die. We were hospice, right? So every teenage girl has probably helped someone die, you know, and nowadays you don't do that when you're a teenager. You have better things to do, or the cemeteries. You don't walk out of church on the way to the car and pass your relatives. That's several miles outside of town. I thought that really put some meat on it about the insulation of death and having neurotic anxiety is actually a way of, again, kind of pushing ignoring death. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in my book Unclean, I talk a little bit about that as well. Basically, all three of my books are about death. I call it my death trilogy. I'm such a happy person, but I have such a morbid worldview. It's really sad, you know. My poor wife. We were talking about death on the way to driving the airport. Why is it when we die, you know, poor thing.
Yeah.
But thanatologists, people who study this kind of cultural aspect of death, characterize the modern condition as what's called the pornography of death. Death is kind of a very illicit subject because it's an intrusive. And there's a shocking aspect of death now that's fascinating. And what I was talking to Jan about the other day is that it was fascinating to us when we talk about lament nowadays, when people talk about, like, what really knocks them off kilter and what we go to the lament psalms for are death of children, death of, you know, so we've had a lot of deaths in our church family where like that. But if you look at the lament psalms, they're not really about death. There's no lament psalms for the death of a child prematurely. There's no lament psalms for the death of a spouse. It's all about injustice in the world and oppression. And I think the difference is that was a culture where death wasn't a shocking experience. They didn't, that the world wasn't being ill run. It was being ill run that the oppressors were winning and God wanted to be. So justice seems to be the theme of the lament psalms, not death. But for us, it's death because I think we're so insulated from death. Yeah. Death is a shock to people, and the reason why it would be a shocking thing is because we're consistently culturally pushing reminders of death to the side. And you might think, well, that's kind of interesting existentially, but I think it affects compassion because the way we deal with the elderly and the handicapped and the way we deal with the poor are all, this is the argument of unclean, we push away any reminders of frailty. And so we have bright, shiny, happy people on stage on Sunday mornings. So I was at a mega church. I was at Andy Stanley's church. You guys know that church out in, and I was watching their worship service and I was talking about unclean and I was equipping them on hospitality stuff. And they asked me, like, what you think of our worship service? And it's great. They got this kind of seeker sensitive model. It was amazing, you know? And I said, but the critique I had was it was deathless. I said, I didn't see anybody with gray hair on stage, you know? It was like a picture of a lack of neediness, and so that inability to kind of be responsive to neediness, I think, goes back to neurotic anxiety because that's the worst sin I think in the world today. It's not being a bad person, but it's being in need, because that reminds us of our contingent, to use a fancy, our contingent nature. So the biggest sin in America today is what? Going into church, like, what's the most shameful thing you could do going into a church? And be asking for money. Like, if you had to ask your friends for money, you could admit to, like, men could admit to each other, I struggle with pornography. Like, that's the most shaming thing. No, it's not. That's not the most shaming thing. It's, I can't pay my electric bill. That in America, that inability to be a needy person. And so our churches become kind of fictions in that sense, where we all go in and go, I'm all right. Arthur McGill, in the book I talk about, we have this ethic of being fine. Like, that's your job in America, is have no needs, be self-sufficient. And work is a way we can do that.
Yeah.
And so work is a way we can get self-esteem, but it's also a way we can insulate ourselves from needs. And so if we're employed and well-employed, then you know, I've done my job and I'm a good person. But if that ever breaks and we become unemployed or chronically unemployed or can't pay our bills, then that's a moral, kind of a moral failure on our part. And so, neediness is the great sin.
Yeah.
Being a human being. That's sad, isn't it? Like being a human being is the greatest sin in the church.
That is sad.
Your job is to be an angel. Like a god, like a demigod like person. You don't need anything from anybody. Yeah. You know, if you do that, then you're great.
And so other things you talk about are principalities and powers. I thought that gets at, you know, at work and business and institutions, whether it's churches or it's businesses. I like some of the powerful stuff there. Sometimes I sit around at Nana and think, and like I said, I've had feet in both camps, and mm-hmm. I think of pre-redemptive work and pre-destructive work. Just that's you make those mistakes running the business, I feel
right.
like. And so sometimes I sit around and think, man, we're making a decision that morally, not one of us would make by ourselves, mm-hmm. but collectively, somehow we can exalt this value of, a for-profit we call shareholder return, right? We might put that as the ultimate value where we can sit around and make decisions that morally we would never make it on our own. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I can hire an individual. I just told my brother last night, I said, I think I pay my babysitter more than my average employee when I first started Mana.
Yeah.
That's a problem, right? Because that was an individual decision. I was able to have a moral kind of leaning there. But it's collective. We can say, well, what's the county average? We'll pay that. You know, that's
right. Yeah.
And make a decision that is, I don't know. I really felt like the principalities and powers section kind of touched on that.
Yeah.
What did you have in mind when you wrote?
One of the things that connect, our battles not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And most of us have tended to view that as a spiritual, like a battle against deep demonic things or whatever like that. But lots of people have noted that's a more political kind of vision, institutional kind of thing. And so that there was a conflation and I'll talk more about this on a thing I'm doing on Friday about angelic troublemakers, about spiritual warfare for progressive Christians. But in ancient culture, there was a more of a conflation between the political, organizational, institutional, and the spiritual, you know. And that's still to this day. It's God and country. There is a conflation there. And so when Moses goes up against Pharaoh, Pharaoh isn't just a Pharaoh. Pharaoh is a deity. Caesar was a son of God, kind of thing. And I look at institutions, and the point I was making in that section was that the way we often achieve self-esteem to deal with the neurotic anxiety is through service or loyalty to institutions, building businesses and serving, being a company man or a woman in that sense. Or at ACU, we talk about bleeding purple. And the institution then, it's because they endure in ways, right? They're bigger than we are, and they have an endurance through time. They were there before I came. They're after whatever. And so, but what happens is, to your point, is, and this is a point William Stringfellow, a theologian I admire, makes, is that you're just trading off one death anxiety for another. You're dealing with your personal death anxiety, my personal meaning, for the institutional's drive to survive.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So the reason why you got to watch, the bottom line of that Excel spreadsheet is because if we don't attend to that, the institution will fail. And so the institution, you're just trading off one death ethic for another. Which can create lots of confusion and struggles. Lots of us struggle with those kinds of things. And it can be particularly in debt. Churches deal with this. I bet what churches are dealing with, the death anxiety of a failing church. What do we do to not die? And in the various compromises we might make. And so you're trading off. So the preacher or the staff is trying to achieve self-esteem through going to church. So they're dealing with their neurotic anxiety. But that's being then wrapped up into institutional death anxiety. And so it's all just a death ethic at work. You're not paying attention to it. But at ACU, when it's a religious thing, it can be really, there's a whiplash effect. And so you get, but all institutions have messianic pretensions. Just read mission statements, like we're all trying to connect what we're doing to stave off death through a paycheck, but we connect it to transcendent ideals. And whenever scarcity kicks in, we always make an appeal to the transcendent ideals. And so whenever budgets are tight at ACU, we kind of recall, the sacrifices are necessary for these transcendent ideals, but in the background, you're like, but at the end of the day, it still feels like this is the last word that the institution will say as it's dying. and institutions of higher ed are struggling, is this is kingdom work, you know, at ACU or like that. But then when push comes to shove, you feel like the last word will always be, but at the end of the day, this is a business. Does that make sense? Which is just another way of saying, at the end of the day, we must survive. Yeah. And then it creates disillusionment, because then you realize, I've just been serving death by another, this is Stringfellow's point, I've been just serving death. And if you've ever been deeply disillusioned by an institution, you've gotten that. Like, I've served loyally, this is the idolatry conversation in the book, I've served loyally, I've done everything, and then, you know, you're let go, and you're like, oh, I was serving the creature and not the creator in my work. And I think, so that's where I think Ecclesiastes is really interesting here for somebody like in that situation. Like, how do you work well, but do it in a way that doesn't create this chasing after the wind that death will ultimately reveal? Because Ecclesiastes gives this weird mixed testimony about work, does it not? It's like, it's all meaningless and vanity. But then there's this like, whatever your hand finds to do, you know, do it with all your strength. And then there's a great text in Ecclesiastes 5. Moreover, when God gives somebody wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, so youth and health, because there's kind of an ode toward youthfulness toward the end, right? Like, enjoy, you know, kind of this ode to the youth. Like, enjoy it now. You're going to get old, you know? So there's, God gives somebody wealth and possessions, the ability to enjoy them, and to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, to be happy in their work. This is a gift from God. You know, and this is the same book where it's like, but it's all, so you get these kind of point, counterpoint, and I think the trick that the book is trying to pull off, and so for somebody that's running an institution, yeah, is how do I realize that, yes, I have to make hard decisions, I have to let people go, I have to make decisions about pay, and sometimes I just got to let the thing die. Mm-hmm. How do I make those decisions and not be chasing after the wind, but this kind of contentment, this is a gift from God. Like, what's that trick? But particularly if I'm, most of y'all are going to be in a for-profit places, that they're not, like, you're selling cars, or you're, does it make sense? You're not,
yeah,
you know, you don't, it's harder to connect it with, this is just a for-profit kind of thing. And so how do I serve in that institution and do good work, when I don't have the, you know, luxury of saying, well, at least I'm saving kids, you know.
The neurotic anxiety.
That's what neurotic anxiety.
That's what, we get to deal with.
That I think is the trick. Like, how in Ecclesiastes do you shift to the vanity, to the this is a gift from God? What is it you're doing in your churches to help people think through work? And I think that's the story that you guys want to tell in the next couple of days, is about how people have tried to navigate that. I have some thoughts about that, but.
Yeah, getting thrown into a company where it's been policy to the point where we're trying to stave off you making your own moral distinctions, right? We're trying to put the boundaries here where you stay, and so you're in this death anxiety of this institution, whether you like it or not. And you're also trying to live out the gospel. That's what you guys got to figure out when you go home. I feel like I haven't figured that out. And like you said, I can always fall back on I can throw a fat kid up there and say, well, at least we're doing that, you know. At least it was worth that, right? The bad things that we did, it was worth that. So, but yeah, you know, some of these guys or some of these folks are thrown into a company where you feel like, man, my ability to have any kind of moral influence here is negligible, you know. And it's much more in the day to day, in the small interactions. Which you have a great quote about the daily asceticism stuff.
Well, the daily asceticism thing is that because I think that's the tension. I don't think we talk about it a whole lot in churches. It's the kenosis aspect of self-emptying. But if you really just kind of trace that, this is back to Schindler's List kind of thing. If you really trace it out, it just seems like you just kind of play that string out long enough. It seems like you just give your way into self-extinction. You know, it seems like, and then it doesn't help that Jesus kind of like actually did that, like actually dies. And so you're like, well, so like, what am I? You know, I mean, yeah. I think at the heart of the Christian ethic is this: we're always feeling somewhat dissatisfied where we draw the line. We're all drawing lines somewhere. At some point we say, you know, I'll give this much and the rest stays in my own bank account, right? Or, I mean, we're all, I mean, whether or not you consciously draw the line, you're just, we're all working with this boundary, and we all feel vaguely icky about that, you know? And so we always want to do a little bit more, but then we start bumping up because we say love is sacrificial, but we don't really think that through, really. You know, love is a sacrifice. Well, okay. At what point, you know, so how much can a business be altruistic? You know, can ACU be Christian in the sense of kenostic self-emptying? Does, you know, at some point, because of our limits of our finiteness and ACU's resources, there is a line, and we feel like at that line is this moral dance that we're going back and forth. And I wish I knew how to manage that anxiety at that boundary. The point of the book is just to kind of pay attention to it a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then maybe try to come through with some better ways of coping with it rather than just kind of living with vague guilt. I've always felt like, I don't know if you guys, do you all just feel vaguely guilty that you shouldn't be doing more? I mean, that's like being an honest Christian, but nobody ever talks about that. You know, like, you know, we all feel guilty that we could be doing more. And
we resolve a lot of that.
That's why I hate Mother Teresa of Calcutta.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, she's out there like, oh. Yeah. You know, there's always somebody like, somebody at your church, like, killing me.
And that's the essence of
the class. They haunt your imagination.
Yeah. That's the essence of the class, is to hopefully sell these folks. That anxiety is real.
Yes.
And the influences that our average congregants, myself, are listening to are oftentimes political or misguided. And so they need folks with theological prowess to speak truth into those, you know, into those moments. And that's what, you know, I don't have those answers. I don't think you have those answers. But I'm hoping these, you know, folks here, you know, never find those answers, but help the folks with that tension, because like you said, it's always this, you know, like I said, the question of when you start a company, what do you pay your employees? Well, a hard decision is, what do you pay yourself? Is a weirdly hard decision when you're trying to feed starving kids who, you know.
Right.
That's a weird, there's this weird tension of, I wish I had, you know, more whatever, more help in this area.
Well, and so we have like 5 minutes to give. Yes. Put a bow on this, maybe.
I want to talk about Freedom of God. I mean, Freedom of God stuff was the best stuff you've ever written. But
yeah.
Buy the book.
Let me come back to Ecclesiastes and let me give you the answer. So you don't have to buy the book. you know, it'll help my neurotic anxiety if you bought the book. Yes, or whatever. Yes. So.
And Sandra, what do you get for each book?
I don't get that much. Really. But if there is an answer here. It is about this idea of creating work as an experience of gift. And so the simplest way I can explain it is going back to the kenosis idea, is that most of us, because we're governed out of a sense of anxiety and a sense of Brené Brown called cultures of scarcity, I don't have enough, or I am myself not enough. So that's basic anxiety. I don't have enough for myself, and I am myself as a person not good enough, and so there's the neurotic anxiety. So each one of us is operating out of psychology of scarcity, and that causes us to hold on to things. Hold on to anything that will threaten our reputation or neurotic anxiety. I become competitive, you know what I'm saying? Like, why didn't Mike give me a book signing gig like Jonathan Storm last night? Like, that hurts my feelings, you know? Like, it's like, my book is better than Jonathan Storm's book by a long shot. Okay? And he also had two people write his book. I did mine by myself, like John Roger. I'm just saying, like, that hurt my feelings.
And you have a day job, too.
Yeah, right. But you know what I'm saying? You become rivalrous and competitive on Facebook. You know, you're constantly, so you get caught up in this neurotic anxiety because you're not enough. You're not enough. You're not experiencing everything you have as a gift. And so you need to grab onto things, and then anybody that's going to take it away from you or diminish it or damage it creates rivalry, jealousy, envy, competitiveness, perfectionism. And then the basic anxiety is like, I can't share because I'm so worried about, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow. And somehow, what I like in that translation, it says, he did not consider status with God something to be clung to. He doesn't go through life like this. He emptied himself. And if somehow work, even for-profit work, can become experienced as a gift from God, then at least there becomes, at that borderline, the capacities to let it go, to pay a little bit more, to take a little bit less, to Does that make sense? So you're trying, you're not, it's, I don't have, we don't have right answers for what to do, but you're trying to create capacity of open-handedness.
Yeah.
And it seems like the open-handedness comes out of the experience of gift. And how do you create that experience? So in the book, I talk a lot about practices from the writer David Kelsey called doxological gratitude. Doxological gratitude are the practices of kind of receiving life as a gift, gratitude. And doxology is worship, but worship is always realizing everything, I receive everything as gift. It also critiques all the idolatrous ways I pursue self-esteem. And so to me, worship is about that kind of contemplative reception of who you are, your identity, and all the resources you have, even your business, even your paycheck. And it starts loosening a little bit up. And so it creates capacities for more giving. You become more generous. Because it's not mine. And it might even involve dying little death or a big death in that sense. And so, you know, this is kind of a dark thing to talk about, but I don't think we talk a lot about the dying in the martyrdom aspect. And some traditions have that. But, you know, we saw like a modern-day kind of almost Christian martyr last night with Kent Brantley, right? I mean, like he literally puts his life on the line in a really risky way, right? Like at one point his wife's going to be widowed. And I think we're called to these kinds of deaths. And but the point I make in the book is that that happens in small ways and big ways. We often go to the extreme. But we're always, in some sense, when we give to another person, dying a little bit of dying a little bit because we're pouring to somebody else. The hard part of that, let me end on this, is the part of the problem with love in our culture is we're still pursuing it as individuals. My job is to save all the hungry kids. You know, it's my job. But you're a bucket that goes that deep, and you're already at your limit. You know, and so you feel exhausted by it or intimidated by it. And so this is why I think the kingdom of God and the church is so important, that love is always described as an economy of neediness. It's not a one-flow direction out of my reserves into you, because that exhausts me. And so if the community... But we got to get past this anxiety in our churches, because if we can't be needy in our churches, then nobody can respond to my need. So we can't, the economy shuts down because of the neurotic shaming. Does it make sense? So until we can overcome that, be needy people that fill each other up, then you have the first century church where there is need being met. It says there are no needy person among them because they were sharing. And so we got to get out of charity mindsets and start thinking about sharing more. We don't talk about sharing a great deal. It's always about charity, you know? But we never ask, like, why does everybody in our church have a lawnmower? That's a lot of lawnmowers. And they're often not being used. You know? I mean, so we don't think about sharing a great deal. We don't think about an economy that can be stepped into. And so it's all about, I go into church, I feel guilty, I try to respond, then I feel exhausted, and then I feel perpetually guilty. That's a trap, I think. And it's driven by a lot of American assumptions about individualism. I don't know if that was a good ending. But
no,
gift.
No.
So gift is a good ending.
Yeah, so quick.
Yeah, give your experience your lawnmower like this. Like
I try to have some provocative slides going as we went. You didn't see them.
I didn't see them.
So just things, areas where you feel like there's major issues, social ills, or examples of wins where folks are doing that, or opportunities for folks to do that. So that was the point of that. But quick question, I'll let you all go to your keynote, is, and man, we always say, you are who people experience you to be. So you can wish to be whatever you want to be. But at the end of the day, we're going to do a review. People below you, beside you, above you, that says you are who people experience you to be. So you, I feel like you go to great lengths to loose, right? To loose in, whether it's, you know, hear stories about prison ministries or dishwashing ministries, you could call it, at work. How are you different because of the gospel? I mean, quickly. I mean,
you
never talk about that in your blogs, right? I feel like you don't talk about work a lot.
Yeah. Like work at ACU?
Work at ACU, day-to-day job.
ACU is principality and power. I'm struggling against it, you know? I have issues with ACU.
We're very thankful.
We experience it all as a gift. Yes. It's a gift, and so...
What are you differently, though? Are you different to your students? I mean, like...
Yeah,
like,
no, I think one thing you do when you are embedded in institutions, even good institutions, bad institutions, is you try to be a sacramental presence of resurrection in that location. And we all have, I often get down on power, but we can use our power redemptively. And so there are ways, because sometimes institutions are just a way to distribute evil, you know, like, you know what I mean? It's not my fault, because that's the policy. You know, it's just a way to just, nobody's, that's the trouble. That's what's, you've entered bureaucratic systems, right? You know, it's just a way of like, no, evil is done, but nobody did it. You know, it's just, I can't do anything for you. Or you could go down in this office and talk to them. and you might like, well, see, that's the government. Well, the government is just like that, but so is ACU, so is any institution, right? Yeah. It's not my fault. I can't do anything for you. So we're all, and so there's this structural way of distributing. But insofar as you are, in the middle of that, and you can say, I can use this scope of power to solve a problem for a student. You know, I get students come in and they're mired in some like administrative tangle, can't graduate or whatever. You know what I mean? And I go, within my realm of influence, I can do this. You know, and so that's what you try to do. You try to use whatever power you have redemptively to help people below you, and so to humanize. That's what you do. I think you can't. The principalities and powers are always going to be governed by a death ethic, but what you try to do is humanize them as much as you can, so the damage that they do is not as acute to your own soul. My classic example of the principalities and powers at ACU is this one student was crying. They came in with this paper. They go, I couldn't print off my paper. Like, why? She goes, I went over to the library, and I ran out of money on my card to copy it. So I went over to the library to put money on it, and they said it was over in this other place. It was over the depot. So they walked over the depot, and they're like, no, it's over at the library. And she walked back.
I've done this. I've been there.
She's like, no, it's over at the... And this girl, the clock is ticking. She needs to turn in her paper to get this grade. Just spent like an hour walking back and forth our campus. You know, Texas, it's hot, right? Back and forth. And just finally just completely broke. She just broke her will, you know. And she just trapped, you know, in it, you know. But what you can do in institutions is go, I have perfect legitimately to opt out of responsibility. There's a policy. You know, I could do that. But this will be my problem. I will become your advocate. And I think Stringfellow is helpful here. Is he says that's the fundamental thing that the church does, is functions. We function as advocates. And also, you speak for and with. Within the institution for people. So I would say that's your mission in institutions, is be an advocate for those, for everybody in the system.
I'm glad we stayed 5 minutes to hear that one.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Hey, tomorrow, Stephen Kinn is here to talk. He's a super talented designer and stuff, so it'll be fun. Friday, Jason Russell, the creator, founder of Invisible Children's. We have some fun things that will be hopefully more kind of examples of how we live out this tension. So,
check out Mano.
You're welcome back. Check out Mano. And so anyway, if you love this, you want to preach this, I have a few books I want to give you guys. So I wanted to help out his scarcity narrative. And so if you want a book, I have it. If you just are dying to read it.
Slavery of Death. Oh, wow.